This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. Hey, Carrie.
I'm here. Hello, Stephen.
Hey. So today we are going to begin a series of shows, really, about an important change that the U.S. Census Bureau has decided it will make for the 2030 census. It's going to add two categories to the race and ethnicity portion of the census. One is for people who identify as Latino or Hispanic. The other is for people who identify as Middle Eastern or North African. These are very big changes that have been in the works for a long time, and they have significant meaning for these communities.
Looking at the process this took, I know they started this initial proposal in June of 2022, where they revised and reviewed their standards. And then in 23, they had the initial proposal of what the changes might be. Then they fielded comments, thousands of comments, and hundreds of listening sessions to get what they have now. And I think I know about, like, locally how the Arab American population would pick oftentimes white or other as a category as well. So I know that'll be a big impact on folks here in our region.
Well, it's about being seen. It's about being seen fully by the government. And I think both of these communities have felt for a long time that that was not just an important change, but that it was a substantive move toward full citizenship even in our country. I mean, the idea that you aren't part of the count. And so we're going to start with Maria Hinojosa, who is the host of Latino USA, the leader of Futuro Media, one of my favorite guests. She's going to talk about the addition of a Latino or Hispanic category. And then on the next Created Equal, we're going to talk about the Middle Eastern and North African category and what that means. Maria Hinojosa, it's great to have your voice with us back here in Detroit. Thanks for joining us on Created Equal.
It's great to be back with you. Hey, Detroit.
So I want to start with just a sense of feeling, getting a sense of the feelings that you and maybe other Latinos have about this switch that the U.S. government is going to make in the census categories. In a way, this strikes me as finally being seen after many years of not being seen. And I guess I'm curious about how that feels, what that means to Latinos here in the United States.
Well, you know, it's interesting because for me, actually, the census is political. You're not surprised, I know, Stephen,
right?
You're not. But you may be surprised by the story that I'm going to tell you. So if I'm not mistaken, it was in the late 60s when the administration of Richard Nixon, actually the Republican who resigned, actually used the category of Hispanic for the first time in the census.
Right.
Now, these were the late 1960s. They were different political times. But the point is that I decided that because this was something that Richard Nixon had done, that I would never...
It could never be good?
ever accept that term. I know. That's very funny. It's funny. You know, I joke about it when I talk about Hispanic. I'm not anybody's panic, but then I am Hispanic and I am her panic. I am everybody's panic.
Right.
So I think you're right. I think that there is, it's good to be having this conversation. But the problem, Stephen, is that where we are in terms of the complexity of Latino reality in the United States of America, this is one of several important issues that need to be talked about. And the first thing that came to mind, and I don't want to, I'm going to say it because it came to my mind, and I'm honest, but I'm not sure I even agree with what I my mind just said too little, too late. And that's not true. It's not too little and it's not too late, but it feels that way a little bit.
Why does it feel that way?
Well, you know, I've been doing a show called Latino USA for 30 years now.
Yes.
And the whole ethos of the show, the reason why we were created was because at that time in the early 90s, there was very little Latino, Latina presence on public radio,
right.
Very specifically on public radio. There was a move to engage Congress and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to acknowledge that we were not being represented. We were, in fact, invisible. Latino USA, I would say, Latino USA was taken very seriously by us, by our audience. But I would say by the powers that be, it was kind of like, oh, isn't that cute? It's another Latino program. It'll be on a couple of years and then it'll be off.
Right.
Kind of who cares? Well, we've been on the air for 30 years because what we have been talking about is the complexity of Latino and Latina reality. Like just having a radio show, a podcast, is the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding how complex we are as a community. And what's happened over the past, let's just say, well, yeah, during the time that we've been in existence, over those 30 years, but most intensely over the past 20, and I would say deeply intensely since 2015, so yeah, almost a decade, where Latinos are somehow perceived as the problem child. You know, like, and it's like, so you only see us as the problem child. That is the story that the mainstream media is telling. What you're not seeing is our economic power. I don't know if you want me to go into all of this right now, but you know, I have some of the data.
Sure.
But essentially, Latinos are helping to prop up the American economy, take us out of inflation,
yeah,
keep unemployment rates down, prop up the housing industry, not only by buying new homes, but by literally building the homes, mm-hmm, everywhere around us.
Mm-hmm.
If Latino gross domestic product were measured as such, we would be in the top 7 gross domestic products in the world, competing with, for example, India. Latinas, younger than me mostly, are the most sought after consumer group in the United States.
Yeah.
Why? Because we are brand loyal. And because we over-index over white women and black women in terms of deciding what will be purchased in the entire household. Latinos, and I'll stop here, Stephen, and now maybe you're getting a sense of like, wow, she's really getting riled up. And that's okay. That's what it's about. Latinos right now, Latinos and Latinas, Latinx, Latine, we are the 2nd largest voting cohort in the United States. You notice I did not say voting bloc because right, we're not a bloc.
Right.
But in terms of percentage and people, we are the largest, 2nd largest voting cohort. So therefore, how we think and feel about democracy is going to determine the future of democracy in this country. So yes, this is, it's good that we're having, I mean, I'm thrilled that we're having this conversation. As you can tell, I'm very enthusiastic about this because it's not just a Latino conversation is right, where I'll leave it, Stephen.
Right. It's an American
conversation. It's about the whole country.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's about the whole country.
Yeah. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, the word Latino means one thing. Now I'm talking about non-Latinos, right? And it encompasses some things, not others. It, as you point out, invokes certain kinds of images. And then for Latinos themselves, it means something else. The key to what the census is doing here, I think, or what's significant about it, is that it is saying that Latino is a race analogous to white or black. Now, I'm really curious about whether that matters, whether that makes the Latino community more seen or properly seen than before, or whether that distinction is not as powerful as it is for black or white people.
And then we get to this point, which is the federal government saying, well, look, we're really trying to help.
I'm from the government, really, and I'm here to help you.
Right. I'm here to help. I want you to feel seen. Okay, so I'm going to go into another level of complexity with you all on this journey with me in Detroit, right? And this is something that Detroit folks know, Detroit Latinos know. The problem is that Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine, we are not a race.
Right, right.
We are not a race. People are going, okay, wait a second. You're blowing my mind here. I don't understand. What are you talking about?
Que pasa mi raza, see?
Right, right, exactly. Now, the thing is that, for example, just take my husband and I. My husband, born and raised in the Dominican Republic, he is African Taino with a smidge of Spanish descendant.
Okay.
Me, I'm a quarter indigenous and then mostly European. Spanish and some Italian. Now, my husband, therefore, is Black and indigenous. That is a racial category. But I'm not a race, right? Like what I would be called in Mexico is mestiza, which would be a mix. Mm-hmm. So how can I be a race if I'm part indigenous but part European?
Sure.
You understand?
I do.
So, and for Latinos, look, we have this, it may be considered flawed, but a way of talking about ourselves as la raza cósmica. Why? Because we are indigenous, we are European, we are Black, we are Asian.
Yeah.
We are all of those things. So if you're Peruvian, Japanese, then you can sign off as Latino here in the in the census, but it's not true. You're not a race.
Yeah.
You're actually Asian and indigenous, for example. Do you see where I'm getting at?
I do.
And also, I'm just going to leave you with this other level of complexity because I know people are like, ugh. So, you are only Latino or Latina in the United States. What are you talking about?
Right.
In other words, when I go to Mexico and people ask me, where am I from? I will say I'm Mexican or I'll say I'm a New Yorker. Uh-huh. But I would not say I'm a Latina in Mexico because everybody in Mexico is Latina, but we don't use that term. We use Latinoamericana. We use Latin American.
Wow.
So when you get to the United States and we are now all, as it were, mixed together, right? We are Salvadorian. We are Peruvian. We are Mexican. We are Colombian. We are Cuban. In the United States, now we're all mixed together and for identity and categorization purposes, now we are Latino and Latina. But actually, we are Peruvian American, Salvadoran American, Dominican American, Puerto Rican, which is all intents. I mean,
right.
Puerto Ricans are born American. With American citizenship. Yeah. Now, do you begin to understand that there's no way that I would be, like, let's say I'm in Argentina and people would say, ¿Y vos de dónde sos? And I would say, yo soy Latina. I would never say that.
Right, right.
But that would mean nothing, absolutely
but here,
nothing.
But here, up till now.
But here it does have, yes.
Right, up till now on the census, you've had really two choices, right? To identify as Black or white. And do you feel like either of those?
No, I would always put other.
You would always put other, okay.
Yeah, I would always. By the way, I mean, anytime I go to any place where you have to fill out this kind of paperwork, a doctor's office, dentist, et cetera, official paperwork, I'm always just like, what am I supposed to put here? So it will make me feel better, as you said, as you started, Stephen. It will make me feel seen, but it's not really correct.
Right.
And ultimately, what we should be doing in the United States is a much more thorough, complete and complex understanding of Latino reality.
Right.
And in doing so, you know, hopefully people would be like, wow, those are really complex human beings. That's very interesting. Wow. So they come from Peru or Argentina or Guatemala or Bolivia or wow, you mean they're not just a mass of scary people who are coming at the border wall and trying to take it down? Now you understand why some of this touches a bone, as it were.
Yeah. So let me ask you a personal question, and you can certainly say none of your business, but when the census comes up next time, will you check Latino as race? Will you participate in the kind of charade that America's asking you to participate in?
You know, there's a lot of charades that we take part in this country. I will check Latino and Latina, or Latina in my case. I will, but I will also, if there's an option, I should be able to check that, you know, I'm part indigenous.
Right.
It's a really important part of who I am. And by the way, Stephen, it's only going to get more complex because one of the things that's happening in this moment with the arrivals of new migrants and refugees from Latin America is that many of them only identify as indigenous.
Right.
We are witnessing an indigenous migration, which, frankly, we should all be, wow, celebrating, applauding, being fascinated by, being interested by the arrival of indigenous people of centuries-old civilizations, mm-hmm. you know, the Quechua, the Inca, for example. Well, they're here in New York City.
Yeah.
And they're selling candy bars in the subway. And because of that, Governor Kathy Hochul decided that they needed to have the National Guard in the New York City subway.
Right, right.
So people who are arriving here now and Latinos and Latinas who have been part of this country for a while are really in the moment also reclaiming their indigeneity. And so having, like I said,
so that
it's
makes
really
it even
good.
More complex.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm telling you. It makes it even more complex. My daughter identifies as Afro-Indigenous. What is she gonna
say? Yeah.
You know, again, she will participate in the charade because she's has a mom who does a show called Latino USA, and so it would be just kind of like but it's not correct, actually. And so in the attempt to do something that they should have done 30 years ago, and at 30 years now, they should have been like, oh, wow, actually, we need to kind of disaggregate this Latinidad thing, and we're going to have to get even more funky with this. That's what should have been happening now if they had done what they needed to do 30 years ago. But sadly, when it comes to issues of race, ethnicity, and power, our country has a lot to live up to. I mean, our core issue of division in this country is the fact that it still cannot recognize what it did in terms of genocide and in terms of human trafficking named slavery.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Maria Hinojosa, the host of Latino USA. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. Our guest is Maria Hinojosa. She is the host of Latino USA, which you can hear on NPR stations all over the United States. Maria, I want to start this segment talking about this moment for Latinos in America and this change that kind of just gets dropped on us in almost the middle of a decade. So we've got some time before we see what the effect will be. But But put this in the context of the fighting that is going on about Latino immigration, the awful things that are being said in the context of a presidential contest, a candidate for president who was president before, who did some pretty awful things, invoking centuries of division and oppression when he was president last time. It seems to me that these two things kind of coinciding is worth noting and trying to make sense of.
Welcome to my life.
Right?
You know, I wonder what would have happened, Stephen, if our colleagues had been smart enough, our colleagues in the mainstream media, for mm-hmm. example, mm-hmm. had been smart enough to really understand everything that we're talking about now, back in the 80s and 90s. In the 80s, we were declared, Time magazine famously declared it was the decade of the Hispanic. The 90s, it was Living La Vida Loca. Mm-hmm. But right smack in the middle of the 90s is also when Bill Clinton, who was appealing to Latino voters to win his election, was also the first one who was talking about, using his term, illegal immigrants, building a wall, stopping illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. Now, if our colleagues in the mainstream media had said, wait, let's just look at the 80s. Oh my gosh. A Republican, Ronald Reagan, a Republican,
yes,
was the one who decided to legalize 3 million undocumented people, the majority of whom were Latinos, majority Mexican. Now, if our colleagues had said, wow, so a Republican just created a pathway for citizenship, it has lifted up our economy. Mm-hmm. It has helped to take us out of recession. And now we have a Democrat who is, in fact, attacking that community while at the same time trying to get their votes. Feels like something is really, really complex about this community. Oh. Also, the population, the numbers, the growth, because it becomes exponential.
Yeah.
If we had approached Latinos and Latinas in the United States with a sense of fascination, with a sense of concrete, fact-based interest in what you were doing, what we were bringing into this country, as opposed to immediately kind of latching on to, frankly, what Bill Clinton started to put down,
yeah,
right? Which was, there's a problem, there's a threat. If our colleagues in the mainstream media had really been independent thinking and actually fact-based, looked at the data and said, wow, look at the population growth. Let's answer some of these questions. What is happening in this community? Is it all bad? Because if you remember, Stephen, a lot of the coverage that we had back then, and it's also true, we were battling poverty and unequal education, as we still do. But yeah, essentially, it became coverage of covering a pathos, you know, something that is wrong with this community. Look at the pregnancy rates. Look at the dropout rates. Look at the crime rates. Look at the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all of that was happening. But there was something else that was happening also, which was Latinos and Latinas were moving into middle class and beyond.
Yeah.
And Latinos and Latinas in our reality in the United States are complex, so that my dad comes here as an immigrant from Mexico because he's recruited by the University of Chicago because, frankly, may he rest in peace, he was a genius. Yeah. He helped to create the cochlear implant, right? My dad was not working in the fields.
Right.
He was working in a laboratory as a medical doctor. So people would, when I tell them that story, they're like surprised. They're like, wait, you're not a campesina? No,
right.
You're not working the field? It's like, this is what we're talking about the complexity again. And had our colleagues really been covering us with all of that complexity, we would have been in a much better place. But sadly, now what's happened, and you and I have been a witness to this, is that we have to spend a lot of time, too much time, having to break down
stereotypes
lies and stereotypes and images that were, you know, that have been used really, really since 2015 is when we saw the turn with Donald Trump. But after 9/11, we saw that a lot too. But we now have to spend all of our time just saying, no, that's not true. Yeah. No, that's not true. No, that's not true. Instead of having a fruitful conversation like the one we're having, which is, well, let's just talk about this for an hour. Let's try to really understand what this is, because the American economy is kind of going to be really counting on Latinos and Latinas. We really need to understand what's going on with them.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I guess I get very worried that the dynamic you're describing is preventing us in some ways from dealing with what is a humanitarian crisis at its core, right? It's become political, and that's how we choose to discuss it. But the large numbers of people who are taking their lives into their own hands to leave where they're from and come to our borders, it seems to me to be at an emergency level. And the conversation that we're having about whether they are criminals or whether they are people who will come here and quote unquote feed off of the economy, all these things, these false things that you just pointed out, obscures the fact that there is something really profound going on in terms of the volume and the reason for the immigration in the first place and how dangerous it has become.
All right. So I was just on the border a couple of weeks ago in the Tucson sector. And as you know, Stephen, I've been crossing the border ever since I was 6 years old,
yes.
Right? Back and forth in one way or another. For all of you Midwesterners, yes, we would all, six of us, pile into the station wagon and drive from Chicago to Mexico every year in the winter.
Yes.
but here's the thing. The dynamic that you are discussing right now, the picture that you have created, is real, except that there's one more other level of complexity that has nothing to do with Latinos and Latinas. Do you know what I'm about to say?
Immigration policy?
No, immigration worldwide.
Worldwide, okay.
The notion that it is still predominantly Mexican, Central American, or even just Spanish-speaking, it's much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
So this takes us away from the conversation about Latinidad, because what's happening is that we are managing a worldwide movement of people
mm-hmm.
based on climate change and issues of insecurity and violence. That's essentially, and in some cases, deeply political issues too. Before, the migration from the southern border was really predominantly Mexican.
Yes.
Predominantly Central American. And now it's really, you're going to see people from all over the world. All right. So that just needed to be said because that is factual.
Yeah.
We have to be clear that what's happening on the border cannot be limited and discussed only in terms of Latinos and Latinas.
Right. And only in an American context, right? It's
correct.
It's happening in many places.
It's happening in many, many places. But sadly, it becomes, again, limited in the sense of the imagery that we see. And by the way, I've been to the border many, many, many times, Stephen. And of course, I'm not saying that what we saw is not real, but what I'm trying to tell you is that if there were a so-called invasion, it doesn't take a pause for, let's say, bad weather or, any external factor. If there is an invasion, right, which is an incorrect term, you should be seeing it throughout on that border. And it's not that way. Again, I was down there for a whole morning. We got down there like at 7 in the morning until like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we saw two migrants, two refugees, who were going to ask for asylum.
Right.
Two. at the Tucson border, which, by the way, again, I'm going to blow your minds because people talk about the wall. Well, it's mixed messaging because just in the Tucson area where I was, it's 21 miles of wall, except there are 19 openings. Wait, what did she just say? So it's not exactly a wall, because a wall means that there's no opening. A wall means you cannot get through. No, what you have here is a wall, a fence, a horrific Darth Vader architecture style. Disgusting, gross, horrific, scary, menacing. But ultimately, there are openings.
Yeah, there's ways to get wall. Through, yeah.
So people are going to come through those openings. And what we have to understand is that it is not these the decision to come to that wall, to that place. If there was a legal way to do it, yeah, right? In other words, stand in one line, you know, and let that line go 3 miles back, but you'll stand in line and you're going to come in and you're going to, which is what, you know, an efficient governmental agency would have figured out how to do. People would stand in that line.
Yes.
It's important that we underscore that what's happening at the border now, what I just saw, Stephen, is very different than, let's say, a decade ago. Or, a decade ago, where you would come to the border and then you'd run into the United States to get away from the Border Patrol. You'd be running away from the Border Patrol.
Right.
No. Now they come, and what we say in Spanish is que se entregan. Se entregan. They give themselves over to the Border Patrol.
Yeah.
Therefore, they're not a threat. They're giving themselves over. They're turning themselves over. They're with their hands up. They're saying, this is my name. This is my ID. This is where I'm going to be. This is where you can find me. They are not sneaking in, trying to hide. That's what's happening.
But at the same time, if we look at the numbers, just the numbers, 2023, 250,000 encounters between the U.S. Border Patrol and migrants. That was a record for a year here in the United States. And if you look back to, let's say, 10 years, January of 2014 is more like 60,000. So, I mean, there are more people who feel like they have to get here. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, because of what I just said.
Right.
If you have climate change, right, or you have organized crime coming after your children or your business, you're going to go.
Right.
That's what people need to understand is that these aren't – I want people to understand that when someone decides to leave their homeland, it's not because they were watching CNN and they heard President Biden say something like, and then we'll offer assistance for those who need it. And then you suddenly say, oh my God, that's it. I'm going to the border. No. These are profoundly difficult decisions that are made.
Yes.
And you're right. There are more people making this decision. But again, based on my reporting, it's basically Haiti, disaster since the earthquake, right? Yeah. So also climate change. Places in Central America, climate change. One too many hurricanes or droughts, the issue of violence against women, very real, the impunity. And then from Africa, you know, I mostly met men who were coming from Africa, and they were just coming because they were desperate to get out of whatever situation, were it political or economic.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things that, it's humanity.
Yeah.
My problem, yeah, Stephen, is that I'm hyper aware of the, as you say, the humanitarian issue.
Yeah.
But I'm also very careful to not use, this is a crisis. This is out of control. This is not manageable. What I will say is that the Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the country.
Yeah, it is.
And they should know their business. And the business of a border is to understand that there is a flow of humanity that is unstoppable. You know, who was the migrant who was moving from place to place? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right.
I'm not Catholic, but I know a lot of people, you know, love Jesus Christ. He was the original border crosser, right?
Yeah.
So the notion that you have a government-run institution, the largest in terms of budget and staff, and they still don't know what they're doing. I mean, this is shameful, especially for a country that says we're supposed to understand immigrants and refugees. That's where I'm coming at, Stephen. Yeah. I don't want to just throw around, it's a crisis. It is, but if we understood this reality, we would be able to manage it without a crisis mode. And it would be so much better for everyone, because really what should be happening is a city like Detroit or any city in whatever state, Omaha, Nebraska, you know, Fargo, North Dakota, should be wanting to get these migrants and refugees. Right. That should be the point.
Yes.
Let's compete. Let's bring them because, oh my God, our city is gonna be incredibly different and better food, cooler people, better music.
I keep saying that Detroit ought to be, you know, putting its name on the top of the list of places that we want these migrants to come, because we have so many needs in terms of population. And look, as you pointed out before, a lot of these folks are skilled people. They could fill the gaps that we have in skilled labor here. They could build parts of our economy. But again, back to the central point of this question, which was the things that we are talking about, the political conversation about this, completely takes us away from all of that and puts the focus on this kind of manufactured danger that you were talking about. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Maria Hinojosa of Latino USA. This is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest is Maria Hinojosa. She is the host of Latino USA and also the founder of Futuro Media. We're talking about the new census categories that will confront us in 2030, which have expanded options for describing what race and ethnicity you are. Okay, so Maria, I want to talk about some of the likely practical implications of this. Of course, we won't know until after 2030 when we all fill out the census again. But one of the things that I think is possible and possibly important is that there will be fewer people who check the white race box on the census. A lot of people say that the quote-unquote white population of the nation has been overestimated for a long time, because lots of Latinos felt like they had to check that box rather than black, and there wasn't a Latino box. So if that's true, and we get a larger population that is identifiable as Latino, whether that's an accurate cultural or racial term or not, it is going to be the designation on the census. What happens? What does that mean for the Latino community? What does that mean for the United States?
So one of the words that we do not use at Futuro Media, which I founded in 2010, actually, you will never hear it come out of my mouth except for right now or in any of the scripts that we write. And that's the word minority.
Yeah.
Because one, I realized I had never actually used that term with my own kids. Like, I had never said to my daughter, "Sweetie, remember you're a member of a minority group." I never said those words to her. So I was like, okay, I can't say this. And also because in our country, we understand what minority has meant up until now, disenfranchised, treated less than, etc. So it is going to be interesting. Again, that's why I said they should have done this 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
This would have helped to ease this problem, because you're right. white America will suddenly feel like, oh my God, we are in fact becoming a minority, and therefore we're going to be treated terribly now. We have to be afraid. Fear, as you know, is a central issue in terms of this election right now that we're living through.
It drives a lot of our politics.
Yeah, it drives so much of our politics. In terms of Latinos and Latinas, you know, it's in terms of our power and visibility in this country, I think this is going to be fascinating. But it's, of course, for me, it's not new, because I've been saying for 30 years, like, hello, you've got to really be looking at this community. The reason why you want to be looking at this community is because of the data that shows, right, what we are actually bringing into the American economy, into jobs, into new business, small business. It's everything that I told you at the beginning. So whether or not Latinos and Latinas will take the moment to own our power, as it were, you're right. We're going to have to wait until 2030. And I really hope that we're not more, you know, beat up by then. Mm-hmm. Because the problem that we're having now is this very clear reality, right? That sadly, I mean, I would say President Joe Biden is attempting to address it. I would say that Vice President Kamala Harris also, you know, I interviewed her for Latino USA specifically because she was trying to reach out to young Latino voters. And then you've got Donald Trump, who is using words and terminology that, you know, I think 20 years ago, we would have been hard pressed to even print when he says the things that he says about immigrants and refugees in this country, which is not true. Again, all of the data shows that crime, specifically in cities where there have been new increases in immigrants, is actually going down. Mm-hmm. And even in the state of Texas, which, you know, Governor Abbott is saying we're just going to have to do horrible things. I mean, he's, as you know, shoot to kill.
Yes.
What are we talking about? What has happened in our country? And that is based on anti-Latino hatred. So, you know, so are numbers growing? Okay, good. But if the conversation is still being that had that we're some kind of a problem, we're it's going to only be more complicated. But we're not going anywhere. We're just not going anywhere.
Does it lend strength or momentum to organizing around the idea of this conversation that you say we need to have, that Latinos are an actual identifiable part of the U.S. population? As you say, they're not going anywhere. They contribute in this way to our economy and to our life. So let's talk about framing all of this really differently.
I mean, I would hope so. I'm not going to wait until 2030. You know, I've been trying to do that all this time, right? Because ultimately, we are in this together, right? Like that's where, you know, when I meet people who live in fear of, let's say, Latino and Latina immigrants, and I meet them wherever I'm traveling, and I will bring them into a reality, and I'll say, well, who are the Latinos who you see around you? Mm. Let's talk about them. Who are they? And when you get to that level of particularity, like who are the people that you see? You may not interact with them, but you're actually seeing them. Can you base your feelings about Latinos and Latinas based on that reality? Oh, I drove by and there were like 10 guys who were putting a roof on at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning. Oh, I went and I ordered from my local diner and everybody in the kitchen is Latino and speaking Spanish. Mm. Oh, I went to my eye doctor and it turns out that my eye doctor is actually from Mexico. Oh, do you understand? Like if we were able to kind of base it in the empirical reality of who you're with as Latinos and Latinas, that would be so much more helpful. Because then it's real.
Right.
Again, as you said, Stephen, and why I love being on your show with you is because we can get into more complicated conversations, because so many people are just now, oh my God, Latinos, Hispanics,
right,
invading the country at the border. Could not be more wrong.
Yeah, yeah. What about in the community where you live? I'm always very curious. I know you're a New Yorker, but you also live in Harlem, which is an important cultural center for not just Latino life, but also African-American life. What does this year and all the crazy things that people are saying and thinking about immigration, what does it look and feel like in a city like New York?
So I love this question. Thank you for asking, Stephen. I just love this question because, you know, as a journalist, we go out and we report. So where did I go? I went to the Roosevelt Hotel to meet with people who are staying what is now being called the New Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. It's the Roosevelt Hotel, which is steps away from Fifth Avenue in Midtown. And when I spoke to the women who I met there, one from Venezuela, the other from Ecuador, you know, and I asked them, do you see yourselves as victims? They were like, no. I said, do you see yourselves as victims or do you see yourselves as women who are going to get things done? They were like, we are not victims. Mm. We get things done. Literally moving their family from Ecuador to New York City, wow. right? So this notion of they're a problem, they come with their hands out. This one of the women said to me, you know, I arrived at LaGuardia and I did look a little lost, but I was not asking anyone for help. And New Yorkers were walking up to me and giving me money. Stephen, New Yorkers at LaGuardia seeing a woman looking like, I just got here, I'm trying, and just saying, you know what, you may need this, giving her money without questions asked in New York. So on the one hand, you have this reality, which is New Yorkers are, they see the new arrivals as just like, okay, next gen, let's do this. Like, good luck to you.
Well, it's a city that has had immigration since it started. I mean, none of this is new.
Correct.
Right.
But sadly, we have our second black mayor, Eric Adams.
Yeah.
And this mayor, unlike David Dinkins, this mayor is a specifically anti-immigrant and anti-refugee mayor has come after immigrants and refugees in a way that has created a divided city. And so Harlem, my community, where I am right now, historically black community, you know, the site of the Harlem Renaissance, the Apollo Theater, like where it all happens, has always been a welcoming community, specifically to African and Haitian and Jamaican migrants and refugees. And sadly, over the last few months, because of the kind of disinformation that the mayor, Eric Adams, is putting out there, I've had my black neighbors, my black community, actually say to me on more than one occasion, but the immigrants. Mm. But they're getting help. Oh, but they're getting free money. Oh, but they shouldn't be here. Oh, but we don't want them in our community.
You're hearing that in Harlem.
And it breaks my heart. Now, not a lot, but from never having heard it, like, you know, in the past 20 years to now I'm hearing it more than once. Mm. We have a mayor who has been effective in his messaging. And by the way, I'm going to go one further that's going to blow your mind. Even on the Spanish language radio stations, even on the Spanish language radio stations, they are spewing anti-immigrant language in Spanish.
So Latinos who are here saying,
yes,
we should not be welcoming these others. Wow.
Saying that same kind of, to say it nicely, BS, which is, that migrants and refugees are coming here and they're getting free apartments, they're getting a check handed to them, they're getting meals, they're getting a warm place, they're getting a job. Not true. But to hear this on Spanish language media, of course, you know, I'm an investigative journalist. Yeah. So, of course, I'm already in, because that just happened last week, by the way, last week. So I'm trying to find out. So who is putting this out there in the Spanish language radio stations saying this kind of stuff? So we have our work cut out for ourselves. But the listeners to your work, Stephen, are the ones who need to realize that we are the ones on the front lines mm-hmm. of this conversation. And we have to be having it with people all around us in ways in which we are celebrating who we are and breaking down the fear. It really, Stephen, I'm at the point where it's like every single one of us has got this responsibility. If you feel this way, you better start talking about it with everyone who you meet, because that's the only way that we're going to save this. Because building a wall around the entire United States of America, which some have said,
yeah,
it's not going to work.
Not even.
And it's not who we are.
Yeah. All right. Maria Hinojosa, it is always great to talk with you here in Detroit. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.